Welcome, everyone. You've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters. Paradigms are actually collections of beliefs that keep us all confined. Paradigm shifters are wonderful beings that are pushing the edges of our parameters and giving us access to more self-empowerment than we've often had. And our paradigm shifter tonight is familiar on this show, a little bit familiar anyway, who's a real master of the biochemistry, the food, the attitudes, and so on, it takes for you and I to deal with might have been a limiting paradigm in our health in opening us up to a whole lot of power. So self-creating power through diet and all. So let's meet Jim Empke. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Well, thank you, Veronica. I'm happy to be here.
I'm very glad you're here. There's a whole, I don't know if you knew it, but there's kind of a crisis going on out there.
I think I know about it.
And I want to know something. I want to know simply, what can we do about it? People are, the worst thing that's happening is everybody is, or they're kind of coaching us to be afraid through all the media and stuff. And I know that fear wreaks havoc on our biochemistry and on our dietary digestion, doesn't it?
Indeed it does. And I think that's a really good starting point in that, you know, we're not victims. I think that that's the thing to consider is that, you know, taking control of your health, which is a theme you're familiar with because of the local classes I teach here in Bellingham, means in a sense that you're not going to be a victim. And victim consciousness is really rife in our population. It's enculturated into us. You know, we think of ourselves as victims of the environment or victims of our bodies or victims of other people or whatever the case might be. But the paradigm shift here is to let go of victim consciousness and be proactive and take control of your health. And there's a lot you can do when it comes to viruses. There's a lot you can do regarding everything, not just viruses, but all types of different conditions. And it involves spiritual, emotional, physical action.
And even those, that little list that you just gave, that can build our immunity, can't it?
Of course. Of course it does, you know. I actually teach a class here locally, as you know, on the immune system. And there's just simply no way around the sleep. There's no way around, how important sleep is to the immune system and the health of the whole body. The attitudes that when you're riddled with fear and anxiety, you have a completely different type of experience. I remember a study that was done in Canada back in the 80s or 90s. It was really interesting where they took the breath. They distilled the breath of hyper-anxiety individuals that were full of stress and anxiety and depression or what have you.
Mm-hmm. They distilled it. Wow. Huh.
Breath has a lot of moisture in it, as you know. Mm. And so if you breathe into a device, you know, you can collect the moisture and distill it and actually have a concentrate of breath, liquid breath.
Wow, that's amazing.
And they did the same thing with healthy, happy, kind of more normal, well-rested, well-nourished, healthy, happy individuals. They distilled their breath. Then they took rats, and if you've ever worked in labs, you know how tough rats are. Oh, my gosh, they are tough, tough creatures. And they shaved them just enough to expose their skin. And the same rat, one side left, one side right, they shaved a little bald spot. And on one side, they put the distilled breath of a person that was hyper-anxiety-ridden, and on the other side, they put the distilled breath of a person who was, like, kind of more happy, more normal, hopefully. And it was night and day. I mean, the distilled breath of the anxiety-ridden individuals actually caused lesions on the skin of the rat, whereas
wow.
the breath of the other group didn't have any effect.
Wow.
So, and what does that prove? It really doesn't prove anything. Is it interesting? Yeah, it's very interesting.
Well, you know something, Jim? I've been telling people how we look at each other has a huge biochemical effect. And so you've just said it in a different, more scientific way. But it's true, isn't it? We really alter one another's inner feeling by how we look at them.
I agree completely. There's so many dimensions to our beingness, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to, the coronavirus or whatever it might be, our attitudes are essential as far as establishing a foundation that's not going to be a victim, not going to blame anybody else, is going to take responsibility for, taking care of ourselves, taking care of our bodies, taking care of our thought process, taking care of our emotions. I mean, to a large extent, if we really look at these things, I think it's fair to say that we choose these things.
Mm-hmm.
But when we're a victim, we often think that somebody's doing this to me or the environment or whatever, the coronavirus, et cetera. But we can choose how we're going to deal with it, no matter what the situation. In this case, it's a little more straightforward, you know, with the coronavirus as far as what to do, how to protect yourself, how to take preventative action, what kind of therapeutic action you can take if you actually contract the virus, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about this strain of virus? Like, what's his, where did it come from, and what's different between this and the flu?
Well, the coronavirus was actually, you know, it was a bat virus, and it wasn't able to infect human beings. And so now there's this controversy about how was it manipulated to be in a position to where it can infect human beings. And I think Dr. Boyle, B-O-Y-L-E, he's the man who authored the bill that was passed years ago dealing with chemical weapon warfare restrictions.
Okay.
And so he's a man of great scientific renown and was at one time, you know, very mainstream. And when control of war and biochemical war was shunned, he was the one who really took the lead and set the tone. Now, Mercola.com, interviewed him recently. He's been interviewed by others as well. And if you want to listen to what he has to say, it's quite remarkable. But he's an expert in this field. He knows biochemical engineering. And he claims very clearly that this coronavirus has been bioengineered so that it would infect human beings.
Thank you. I'm sure that's true, but I have no evidence.
Yeah, and he's the best person to, because this is his field. You know, this he lives and breathes this whole field, and he was an insider.
Hmm.
And so he knows the inside scoop about this type of information.
Hmm.
And so somewhere along the line, you kind of pick people that you trust and people that you don't trust. But it is well known, coronavirus is not new, but its ability to infect human beings is new.
Mm.
And there have been other, projected or suspected manipulations to the virus that Dr. Boyle points out as are very clear. But again, I'm not an expert in that field, nor are you. And I just know that it's a controversial subject. And historically, the coronavirus was not able to infect human beings, and at least this particular strain. And apparently it was isolated in bats and then manipulated so that it would infect human beings. And let's face it, I think that we'd be naive to think that the governments of the world, including the three primary, you know, the United States, Russia, China, aren't in the business of bioengineering biological weapons. It's just kind of like making nuclear weapons and, you know, making all these different weapons that governments make. It's just one of those, it fits right into that category.
Well, I've heard people say they think it's because they want to reduce population. Is that it?
I have no idea why. We can speculate. That's the purpose of it. I mean, I've heard all different types of theories about why it's been released, or was it an accident? That was, I think, one of the original theories, that was accidentally released from a bio lab in China. And then I read an article about this stage 4 or classification 4 biolab. I guess that's one of the highest classifications in Canada, which is sort of like an extension of the U.S. biolab. And they had a variety of Chinese scientists there. And some people think it was smuggled and it got into China and it was released by accident. I really don't know. And, you know, the bottom line right now is that's all water over the dam. Let the politicians sort that one out, if it ever gets sorted out, because I don't know that it will ever get sorted out.
Mm-hmm.
But now that it's in the population, so to speak, worldwide, which is what one of the things that really distinguishes, you know, an epidemic from a pandemic, it's
mm-hmm.
worldwide,
mm-hmm.
is what are you going to do about it? You know, how are you going to take responsibility for how you deal with it?
Well, this is a little sidebar. Do you think HIV and AIDS were the same kind of thing? Like, not the same virus, but the same approach to perpetrating
AIDS? You mean like a bioengineered type of a viral situation? No, I don't. But I could be wrong. I really don't know. You know, but it's never really struck me that way, going back to that era when it was news and it was big and it was really difficult to control. I don't know if that was intentionally released into the community or not, but I know there's tons of theories about that type of thing, and I don't know enough about that level of it to really add any credence to any of them.
Well, it's just sort of a little interesting, or it's a moot point at this point. Can you help us deal with it? I know people are panic-stricken, and I'm going, wait a minute, I don't think it kills everybody. I think it's got, you know, a margin of people that are vulnerable, but I don't think it kills everyone. Do you?
No, obviously it isn't. There are people that have recovered, and I know they're running. I saw a statistic the other day that were around 98 or 100,000 approximate cases and 3,000 deaths ballpark. And, you know, people are saying 2, 3% death rate. And I wouldn't discount that. And yet it's if it really does develop into an extremely common thing, who knows what's going to happen with that the death rate. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know if 2 or 3% is considered significant. I wouldn't consider it insignificant, but relative to viruses and pandemics and things of that nature. But I think it's too early to tell right now, because if this becomes virtually ubiquitous in the culture, you know, it's all over the place, I don't know, because you have a lot of people that would probably, I'm sure, would be more vulnerable than others, people that are not in good health, people that have compromised immune systems, aging people. I mean, heck, I'm almost 70, so, you know, I guess I have that category. Well, I won't ask you your age, Veronica. So
I'm 76.
You sound so great for 76. I'm impressed.
Well, you know, I wanted to throw that out because in a way I'm kind of proud of my age, but I know that it's to keep getting strong as you get older is a job.
Right? It is.
And I'm trying to do that with people like you and my team.
Mm-hmm. Sure. No, I understand totally. As I'm in the aging process, we're all in the aging process. It's only a matter of the degree to which we're in it.
But some people are very, very, very vulnerable, and there's no question about that.
Sure, and here in Seattle, you know, we have the nursing homes. You have obviously a lot of vulnerable people in the nursing homes where it would be an issue. So
let's use that as an example. What would we do to build, I mean, outside of attitude, which I think is so important, and building up your emotional confidence sort of thing, but what do we do to build our immune system, and how do we help others do that?
Well, that's what we want to look at. And
yeah.
So some of the basics are, you know, sleep. Your immune system needs sleep. Now they're finding out that, you know, sleep's a big issue with Alzheimer's risk factors. They just found out recently, last couple of years, that the brain actually has a lymphatic system. They call it the glymphatic system.
Mm-hmm.
But sleep is so crucial for so many functions in the body. And let's face it, we live in a culture that's go, go, go. It's a sleep-deprived culture. We used to joke years ago that when people got sick, it was just it was just to catch up on sleep, you know?
Right.
That's number one.
And the food. The food has been deprived of a lot of nutritional support, too.
Absolutely. You know, as I was saying to a colleague recently, I was thinking, when you look at the overall health of the American population, the obesity rate, the diabetic rate, you know, all the meds, the drugs, illegal, legal, whatever, I would think that we don't have a really healthy, tip-top population to deal with this.
Mm-hmm.
If indeed it really does move on, as some people are anticipating or projecting. And we don't know that yet, you know. Now, China just claimed, I think today, that they have turned the corner, that they have it
under
control.
I heard that. I want to believe that.
Yeah, I mean, that would be great. Now, I was talking to a person who lives in China, who lives a couple hundred miles from Wuhan, and she told me that they were under martial law. They mm-hmm. could not leave the house. There were police and soldiers everywhere. And so China just implemented the strictest possible, you know, procedures to control the population and prevent any kind of mass exposure, and they have the wherewithal to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have a population that's already under pretty strict control, and they just literally implemented martial law.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what's going to play out in the United States or how this is all going to play out in general, but we'll see. It's going to be a lot harder to control the United States population than it is for the Chinese to control their incredibly large population.
Mm-hmm.
And they were quick on the gun. You know, they jumped right on it and said, it seemed like it was an overkill, especially to the gal I was talking to on the phone. She says, well, I don't think they're telling us everything, and it seems pretty extreme. But if they really did turn the corner, well, then I would expect to see similar measures applied in the United States. And now Italy just closed doors. Nobody's in or out. They quarantined the country as far as foreign visitors, et cetera. And that was today or yesterday, right? So
yesterday.
You read about that.
Yeah, if they give it 2 weeks, that should make a difference, right? We should know if there's effect on that, huh?
Yeah, you know, the incubation period of the virus is considered to be a couple weeks, whatever. I mean, I guess this is still all being proven or playing out, and we'll see what happens with that. But it does lay dormant for a while, so you don't really know, apparently, if all the information we're getting is accurate in this regard. We don't really know how long it takes to incubate, but apparently you can be exposed and literally infected for quite a while before you actually develop symptoms.
Hmm.
So, and the person from China that I was speaking to, and I received an email from a family member who's got a physician friend in China, and they were saying that, you know, you can tell the difference between a regular flu and a coronavirus flu by the nature of the cough.
Okay.
The coronavirus cough is dry. It doesn't have any, you know, mucus associated with it. If your nose is watering and you've got a wet cough, it's not corona. That's what they were basically saying. And this person was a physician in China, and that's the one group in China that was not quarantined, as they had to get out in the field and do their work, and so this came from them.
Hmm.
So I'm assuming it's accurate, but I can't stand by and say I know it for a fact. But that's what I was told in this email from a friend in China.
Hmm. Did any of the doctors get the virus?
I assume I've heard that that's the case, that, you know, healthcare handlers are at great risk.
Right.
And one of the things that happened in the United States, which is a political hot potato, is that the healthcare workers that handle these people on the cruise ship, you know, wherever that wherever. Coming into the U.S. and they were being screened and tested, that they weren't prepared for it. They weren't properly attired and secured, mm-hmm. Relative to being exposed to the virus. So that was pretty hot a week or so ago that these people were exposed.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how we're going to handle this here at a logistical level and a political level, but I, you know, again, we're more focused on what we can do, you know, in our lifestyle.
I just want to add one little thing. You and I live right by the Canadian border, and apparently they've stopped people going. I think it's into Canada, right?
Really?
Yeah.
Darn, I was going to go cross-country skiing in Canada this weekend.
Well, maybe they'll let you in because you know what you're talking about. But I heard that because I'm Canadian, as you know. And I went, wow, that's really interesting. Hey, yeah. It's a way of kind of controlling.
And you have a Canadian passport?
I do, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll have to mention that to Karen. I had no idea, so they closed the border. Well, yeah.
So check it out before you go cross-country skiing, right?
The question is, if I go cross-country skiing, will I be able to get back in?
That's a very good question.
Well, it is... Yeah, the United States is behind the curve, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
And you know, we didn't even have any. We had like a couple hundred testing kits.
I know.
And now they're. Yeah, that was in. You know, that was reported. And so, you know, I guess President Trump ordered 2 million, and they said, or we're going to have 2 million. They said, well, we might have a couple hundred thousand by the end of the week. And now, right here in Seattle, I read this today. Bill Gates is going to offer tests to the city of Seattle, I gather. I didn't get into the details of this, but something's mm-hmm. happening big with the Gates Foundation mm-hmm. relative to testing people. And then I just saw a thing today is some senator, I don't recall his name, says, hey, Americans should be able to be tested free. I mean, because who knows how much these tests cost. In the United States, that's always an issue. I don't think it was in China, but I don't know. That could be a point of reluctance. People don't want to test because it's going to cost them a couple hundred dollars or whatever. So this congressman or senator was saying, hey, this testing should be free.
Mm-hmm. No, it should be, shouldn't it? It should be also compulsory, really.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not, but I think because it's going to show up on its own, isn't it? Well, I don't know. I just think we should get a little organized here.
Yeah, compulsory is always tricky, but I can understand testing. You know, then you get into when they're going to come up with a vaccine, and should that be compulsory, and do we know that it even works? I mean, there's never been a vaccine that's been put to the gold standard, which is a placebo-controlled double-blind study. You know, mm-hmm. there's not a single vaccine ever that's gone through the gold standard of testing, which, again, is placebo-controlled double-blind study. And also, vaccines work at the humoral level, which is the antibody level. That's humoral immunity. And one of the things that I've been reading in Dr. Blaylock's newsletter, Richard Blaylock, he's a physician. He's actually an MD neurologist, but he's gotten way into this field, and I don't even know if he practices neurology anymore. But he points out that when you're dealing with this type of an organism, you're dealing first with cell-mediated immunity, the cells, and then the antibodies are like more the secondary situation. And so he said he expressed serious doubts that vaccines are even going to work against viruses. Now, I realize he's going to receive a lot of criticism for that, and we have more or less been inundated with the idea that vaccines are infallible. And of course, they're not. In fact, if you've been reading Mercola lately, he just did a big thing on HPV, human papillomavirus, and the Gardasil vaccine, which has been a disaster. And all these people are developing cervical cancer from
the vaccine. Oh, my gosh, really?
Yeah, I just read the article about 2 weeks ago, maybe. But
wow.
If you go to Mercola.com, type in Gardasil. Mm-hmm. Or HPV, Gardasil vaccine, you can read about it. And it's all court-reported. It's not like Dr. Mercola's theory. It's he's just quoting, you know, court records and experts, and it's a huge issue.
Wow.
And I realize the vaccine topic is a topic perhaps for another day. They don't have a vaccine now, but Congress just released $3.6 billion to deal with this virus, and my guess is the vast majority of that's going to end up, you know, with drug companies trying to develop a vaccine.
Well, I just want to throw in another very uncomfortable thing for me. I was learning from something I was reading that, for example, in Venezuela, if you don't have all the vaccines, then you can't have a driver's license or a passport or anything. So
yeah,
vaccination has got a bit of a taint, huh?
Well, it's controversial, you know, and so what I like to say when people want to debate the subject, because I don't like to get too much into it, is show me the science. You know, show me the placebo-controlled double-blind study. Show me that they work. They're generally, you know, there's nothing there to prove them. And you have to understand, too, the economics. And it's not just that they're profitable. It's just that in 1986, or approximately 33 years ago, I think it was 86, the drug companies petitioned Congress that they were no longer going to make vaccines because they couldn't afford the liability associated. They were paying out billions of dollars in damages and liability.
Hmm.
And that unless they received immunity or exemption from liability, they weren't going to make them. And so Congress made a deal that they would receive immunity. That's not the right word. Probably they would be exempt from any liability. But the government formed a vaccine court. So there is a government vaccine court where if you're damaged by vaccines, you can sue the United States government for damages. And they've paid out, you know, billions of dollars over the years in these last 33 years that the vaccine court has been in existence. Most people don't even know that exists.
I didn't know anything about it. But I guess it's different for every person or different, you know, according to my biochemistry or my history and so on, I would have a different effect than you, right?
Well, it is individual for sure. And but I want to finish wrap up on the vaccine court.
Yeah, please.
And
mm-hmm.
The drug companies received exemption from liability, but there was a rule in the law that stipulated that every 2 years, I mean, the government's saying, well, if we're going to take on the liability, then you have to show us that you're working towards vaccine safety. So every 2 years, you have to submit to Health Human Services, HHS, you have to submit your data on your updated vaccine safety studies. And now Robert Kennedy Jr., who's been a champion of safety in vaccines, he petitioned for this information. And he was stonewalled. He went through Freedom of Information Act, and he found out that there has not been a single updated vaccine safety study submitted in the 33 years that this law has been in existence.
Wow, really?
Yeah, I heard him do a five-minute interview on Fox News, and I'm thinking, here's this ultra-liberal, you know, Robert Kennedy Jr., and he's being interviewed by Tucker Carlson on Fox News. And at the end of the, and I showed in the class here on immunity, 5 minutes. And at the end of the interview, Tucker says, well, you know, are you sharing this message on other networks? And Kennedy says, no, they won't let me talk. They won't let me speak and discuss this subject. You know, he said, so I'm thankful for Fox News to have me on. I'm thinking, well, this
wow,
is a
good time. How strange that is. I would have expected it to be different.
Exactly. But it's not. And so there's a real, attitude that vaccines are the end-all and the be-all, and they're really not. And we're going to find that out more and more as time goes on. I'm not saying they don't have their use. People who want them, they're perfectly, I think, fine to have them. And people who don't, I think, should be allowed not to. But that's my own personal opinion. And I know that's going to, you know, a lot of people are going to disagree with that, and that's just the way it is. But we should have open discussion. It shouldn't be like if you're not vaccinated, you're shunned. Mm-hmm. I mean, I saw an article that said that somebody was putting together an app that would tell you everybody in your area that's not vaccinated. That's kind of like what's happening. I guess you said in Nicaragua. Did you know?
I think
said
it was. I think it's Venezuela. No, I'm not sure if I have the right country, but I think it was Venezuela.
That strikes me as pretty peculiar for Venezuela, but who knows? That could happen here too. I wouldn't be completely shocked. But looking at the biochemistry, the sleep, the diet, and particularly the use of supplements as a prevention, I kind of like Blaylock's approach. And what he does is he recommends a gentle preventative program, which would be doing something every other day with the right use of supplements, a more aggressive preventative approach, which would be every day, and then a therapeutic approach, so that you have those options. And right now, I think it would be really reasonable to be into a general preventative mode, do something every other day, mm-hmm. or a daily preventative mode.
So what does the preventative mode look like? Go ahead. Sorry. I'm sorry I interrupt you. I'm excited. That's all.
Yeah. Well, that's. I'm actually putting together a mailing on this so that I can share it with clients and friends.
Good.
So his number one recommendation is vitamin D. I mean, vitamin D is a profound antiviral. That was my first exposure to the tremendous benefits of vitamin D, as in David, just so there's no confusion about D or B or C or whatever. It's vitamin D as in David. And that my first exposure was back in the early 2000s when the University of Wisconsin-Madison was doing research on vitamin D, and they were like completely taken aback by what a profound antiviral it is. And that was before it became well known, relative to bones and relative to cancer, because it's a great anti-carcinogen for prostate, colon, breast cancer, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So, and it's just a great antiviral. And his recommendation is like 5,000 units, every day or every other day as a preventative type of a measure. I've been into vitamin D therapy for a long time in my practice, and I try to move everybody up to the mid-range minimally. Mm-hmm. The range for vitamin D in the blood test is 30 to 100 nanograms per liter. So we want to be, at least 65, which is the exact mid-range between 30 and 100. And that's where I try to keep my vitamin D level, and I test it periodically to be sure that. And I work with people routinely that are under 10, routinely under 20. And a lot, I would say the majority of people that aren't taking vitamin D are under 30. Hmm. It's astonishing how low the vitamin D levels are in people.
But Jim, and it's not because it's cloudy here, is it? Or is it?
Yeah, well, we had sun the last couple of days. And the summers are beautiful, so in the Pacific Northwest. And when you're this far north, the likelihood of you getting any significant, vitamin D from the sun is, minimal after September 1st. You probably got, July and August to pretty well get as much vitamin D as you can. And how many people are outside in bathing suits or working on a farm and sweating and getting tan in the summer, really collecting vitamin D or accumulating it, and that's why it's fat soluble. So you get it in the summer, you store it for the winter. Mm. When you go into the southern climates, people are darker skinned so that they don't absorb as much, UVB, as in boy, ultraviolet B, mm-hmm. Which is what generates vitamin D when it interacts with cholesterol. LDL cholesterol is what makes vitamin D from sunlight. Mm. This whole cholesterol thing is the bad cholesterol LDL. Well, only oxidized LDL is capable of contributing to plaque, and you can actually measure oxidized LDL in a blood test. Regular, healthy, normal LDL is a worker bee in the family. It makes all of our steroid hormones, estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, cortisone.
So we shouldn't be worried about cholesterol then?
It depends on the situation, depends on the individual, but this whole idea that LDL is bad cholesterol is not only nonsense, it's not scientific. Mm. It makes vitamin D, it makes all of our hormones. Cell membranes, when you squeeze a muscle or tissue in an animal, it bounces back. With a plant, it breaks, it snaps. There's no cholesterol in plants. So what allows the cell membrane to be elastic and to return to its original position under stress or under pressure is LDL cholesterol. A healthy cell membrane should be approximately 50% LDL cholesterol. Hmm. So, it's a marketing ploy to say that all LDL cholesterol is bad. And if you really want to know, you do an oxidized LDL cholesterol test. And when I go back in the 60s and the 70s, the University of Wisconsin, it was You know, I remember sitting around with Karen, my wife, you know, when I got a master's in nutritional science, and her roommates, and we're studying cholesterol. It's kind of like, wow, the new thing, cholesterol, you know, this is really interesting. And all of the work then was on oxidized LDL. Oxidized,
ah.
I mean, rancid. Yeah, it was oxidized LDL, and then the immune system sent out white blood cells. I think macrophages were what were referred to at that time, and they engulfed the oxidized LDL because the body, the immune system, identifies it as a free radical. And a free radical is a substance that will damage other cells and can even set up chain reaction damage. And so so the immune system goes, oh, there's a free radical, an oxidized LDL, get it out of the way, clear it out of the system, and then it takes the oxidized LDLs, you know, white blood cells, and deposits it as plaque. And that was the original cholesterol theory back in time, and it still holds, but it kind of morphed into all LDL is bad, and it's a great, you know, great strategy for selling statin drugs, but it's not science.
So if we take our vitamin D, we won't have that problem?
No, vitamin D doesn't really, you know, fill into that. It doesn't fall into that category, but if there is a high level of oxidized LDL, then it needs to be dealt with, and there are ways of dealing with it, and I know that's not our subject now. I just kind of digressed into that because we're talking about, sunlight and vitamin D, and it's the cholesterol in the skin that makes the vitamin D, which is why it's called cholecalciferol, right?
So, yeah, really.
You know, the name itself tells you it was made from cholesterol.
And one more question is, you don't, in the very warm, sunny climates, apparently we can be vitamin D deficient as well. Is that right? I've read that.
I lived in Hawaii for 8 years and did a lot of vitamin D testing there. From 2000 to 2008, and the majority of the population was barely adequate, if at all adequate. But then we're living behind windows, we're living in cars, we're wearing clothing. So I did a study in Hawaii just on myself. I thought, what the heck, I'm going to try this.
Mm-hmm.
So every day at lunchtime, 12 to 1, high sun, high noon, tropical sun, I went out in the backyard, had lunch, read, and all I wore was a swimsuit and a hat. But by then I was seriously tan. I mean, I'd been in Hawaii for a number of years, so I had really adapted to the sun. But I was in a swimsuit. If I got too hot, I put a hat on. If I had, you know, but I really did maximum sun exposure for an hour every day for a month. And at the end of the month, I went to Hawaii Clinical Labs, had my vitamin D tested, and it was 65. It was exactly in the mid-range. I was taken aback by it. I thought, gosh, that's the goal. You want to be mid-range, you know? So, and Dr. Mercola, he doesn't take any vitamin D, but he lives in Florida, and he does maximum sun exposure, safe sun exposure. And the last I heard, I think he said his vitamin D was around 80.
Hmm.
So, you know, you can do it if you're living in that kind of an environment for most of us, and, you know, it's something that we need to take. And so the recommendations that I have for general prevention are 5,000 units every other day, or 5,000 units daily for more aggressive prevention. I would think that if you're really, you know, at this time in this climate that we're in right now with coronavirus, I would do the daily prevention personally,
okay.
And that'd be 5,000 a day. And if it's therapeutic, I would take 10,000. I have no qualms about recommending 10,000. I've taken that much myself. I've worked with clients as high as 20,000, but then I'm checking their blood levels. So if you're doing 10,000 IUs a day, which would be, I believe, 250 micrograms. The FDA has now forced manufacturers to switch from international units to micrograms, which to me is like, why bother? Don't you have anything better to do? But just more and the conversion of micrograms to international units is different for vitamin D. It's different for vitamin A. It's different for vitamin E. It's like, oh, geez, make it complicated for no reason whatsoever. Everybody relates to international units because that's what's been used forever to measure fat-soluble nutrients, right?
Right.
Okay, so then continuing with the general recommendations, preventatively and therapeutically, N-acetylcysteine. N-acetylcysteine, NAC, it's often is the acronym that's often referred to, or even NAC, NAC, N-acetylcysteine, is a wonderful immune booster because it's a precursor to glutathione, and glutathione is one of the kingpins of the immune system. It's so important in the body, and you can enhance your glutathione with NAC, and interestingly enough, it has been specific to lung therapy for a long time. You know, in clinical nutritional therapy circles, if a person has COPD or asthma or, you know, chronic lung or respiratory issues, you always want to use NAC as one of the supplements to support their system. Blaylock's recommendation is 750, usually 600 milligrams is a more common dose, so I say 600 to 750 milligrams every other day or daily. And then during a therapeutic phase, it would do twice a day.
Okay, I'm writing this down. Excellent.
Yep, another one that is become well known in internet circles, and Blaylock recommends, is vitamin C. He feels that you can't absorb a lot of vitamin C at one time, and he may very well be right, but I've seen nothing but benefits with it. So my take is, if it's every other day or daily as a preventative, 1,000 milligrams a day would be fine. And I would double that in a therapeutic situation, 1,000 milligrams twice a day, and even more. I mean, Russell Jaffe, who's a physician, MD, who used to work for the CDC and is now, one a top premier alternative doc, he has the vitamin C flush, which can achieve, tissue saturation. He has you take basically a teaspoon of vitamin C powder every 20 minutes until you get loose stool, watery stool.
Okay.
Yeah, and that, in theory anyway, is supposed to alkalize the cellular environment and have real cleansing benefits, detox benefits at that level, cellular level. And again, like Blaylock points out, when you're first exposed to a virus or anything like this that's in the throat and the windpipe and the lungs, it's cell-mediated. You have to deal with what's going on in the cells. And the way viruses kill is the immune system knows this is going on in the cell, that the cell's been infected. Of course, the virus is like a pirate that captivates the cell and turns the cell's energy into its own purposes. It's very different than a bacteria, so it engineers the cell to its own benefit because it needs the cell. But the immune system reacts to that and dumps a lot of cytokines, and cytokines are inflammatory agents. Now, this is an appropriate response to an extent. But some people have a predisposition to being hyperactive immune system to start with, and these would be autoimmune people. That's autoimmune. The definition is hyperactive immune system, where instead of going 50 miles an hour, the immune system is going 100 or 150 miles an hour. It's out of control, damaging healthy. Well, the cytokine storm is the word that's often used that the immune system secretes to deal with this virus can get out of hand, and it can get out of control. And then the cells to the point where there's a lot of fluid that's released, and that fluid accumulates in the lung, and that's how it kills. It kills by the accumulation of fluid in the lungs. It basically shuts down the respiratory function by accumulation of fluids. And this is what pneumonia is, right? Pneumonia, when you want to diagnose pneumonia, a doctor takes an x-ray, and if you have fluid in the lungs, well, then it's pneumonia.
I thought you said this was drying. The cough was dry. I thought that meant that the lungs were missing fluid.
Well, that's what I heard from China, Okay. But people with pneumonia, you're not coughing that fluid up. The lungs are big,
Okay.
The lungs are actually, by actual size, the lungs are the largest internal organ in the body. The skin is the largest organ in the body, but the lungs are the largest internal organ. And if that fluid is accumulating in the lower lungs, you may not cough up wet. So, and that's what I heard. I mean, I don't know for a fact that if it's a dry cough is the cough. That's what I heard from China. So that's anecdotal. I don't know that that's a fact, but that's what I heard from a friend who has a doctor friend in China.
Okay.
Yeah. So we want to be careful there, too, because there's so much information out there. But that's, hopefully that's legitimate information, and we'll see how it plays out. Hopefully it won't even be an issue, that this whole thing will never really take hold and get traction like some people are speculating that it will.
Or maybe it could, but if we are doing some immune attention work, we might be able to bypass it anyway, right?
Right, exactly. So even if you're exposed, why is it that you walk into a room where there's a flu or a cold or whatever going around, and some people get it and some people don't? I'm sure it's going to play out the same way. Your own immunity, your own ability to deal with it is going to be a major player in here. That's why people that are run down or already ill or are compromised in some way or just aging, like in the nursing home situation in Seattle, are going to be much more vulnerable. And so far, this coronavirus thing has been primarily elderly, or the demographics is older people like us. And young people have really very little, at least at this point, there's very little record of young people dealing with it. Also predominantly male, which is another interesting thing. I don't know the exact statistic, but I was under the impression it was maybe like 60, 2/3 men, 1/3 women, just as a rule, but not that that matters, because it's basic immune system support that we want to implement. So getting good sleep, having a really high-quality diet that's vegetable-oriented. You don't have to be a vegetarian, But vegetables offer so much diverse nutrition, so many benefits with fiber, and there's everything about vegetables is beneficial.
Yeah.
A little bit of protein, and maybe some whole grains, some legumes, some simple things, some whole fruits, but not a diet that's high in sugar, like the typical American diet, somewhere between 150, 200 pounds per person in sugar. You know, 10 years ago, the per capita soda pop consumption in the United States was 45 gallons per person per year. I mean, well, people say that seems impossible. Well, one 12-ounce can a day is 34 gallons a year.
Hmm.
So, yeah, it's a realistic number. But if you're on a junk food American diet, there's no doubt in my mind you're going to be more vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether it's to kill you, I don't know. But to be infected and to struggle with symptoms, I think is going to be pretty common, if indeed this virus plays out the way they're projecting it. And we don't know that yet.
Mm-hmm.
But it is suspicious. And I always take the attitude like, is this for real? Because we've seen the bird flu, the swine flu, and all these different flus that got all this publicity and they never really took traction. But this one seems to be different. So I'm kind of walking the middle road. I don't want to get too much involved with the politics and everything. Go to Boyle. Go to Mercola and see the interview and the article on Dr. Boyle. That will give you the science of this whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can look at different news sources and decide for yourself what the politics is. But basically, from a science standpoint, from a nutrition standpoint, from a health standpoint, that's what I'm going to focus on.
Hmm.
Vitamin C, very important, and the vitamin C flush is one way to get dramatic vitamin C therapeutically. A teaspoon every 20 minutes, teaspoon of vitamin C powder is going to be 3 to 4 grams or 3 to 4,000 milligrams on average, depending upon the brand. Get a buffered vitamin C so it's not acidic, or use sodium ascorbate, and until you get watery stool, and then you'll reach vitamin C saturation. And the point then is you calculate how much vitamin C it took you to get loose, watery stool, and you take half that amount every day. So that's kind of the vitamin C flush in a nutshell.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like a good way to rebuild, huh?
Yes, very good therapeutically. It's a great anti-infective. And, you know, vitamin C IV is really powerful. And, Dr. Mercola did that article on the doctor who uses it for sepsis. And sepsis causes a huge number of deaths in the United States. It's in the top five as far as deaths.
Wow. I didn't even know that. What did we get it from?
Sepsis is a bacterial poisoning that gets out of control in the body and shuts down the kidneys, typically, or some type of vital organ.
Hmm.
The fatality rate is astonishing. And if you go to Mercola.com and you just type in sepsis, S-E-P-S-I-S, you can see this 10-15-minute interview with this emergency room doc. He's in his 50s or 60s. I mean, he's been around. This guy knows sepsis. And he says, you know, first time I exposed to this, I had a patient who was dying of sepsis. I went home that night, and I knew they'd be dead in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, but we put him on, I heard about the vitamin C, and they also had some B1. And it wasn't even all that high a dose. I think it was maybe 10 grams or something, but I can't verify that specifically. But it wasn't an extremely high dose of vitamin C, which some people go IV vitamin C 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 grams.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, but I tried it. I came in the next morning, the guy's improving. And he
wow.
said, well... You know, he said, I don't need to jump out of a plane without a parachute to know that parachutes work. And, you know, if this works, I'm going to use it because these people are going to die for sure when they come into the ER with sepsis.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, it got no publicity, and I don't know what's happened since then. But if you go to Mercola.com, M-E-R-C-O-L-A, and you just type in sepsis, it's a free website, you can see the interview yourself. But the vitamin C is powerful, and when you do it IV, it's really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
That way you don't have to worry about it. Because that was Dr. Blaylock's point, is that you can only absorb a couple hundred milligrams or whatever. So if you're going to use vitamin, he felt you didn't need to go high dose orally. I've just seen so many benefits from high dose vitamin C that I'm holding to it, regardless of what somebody else might say.
Yay.
Another
I'm really for that.
Mm-hmm.
for that.
I realize I'm going fast here, so if you want to get a point in, please interrupt me.
It's okay. I'm having a great time.
Okay, another is zinc. You know, zinc is very antiviral, and
mm-hmm.
zinc lozenges get right in contact, you know, with the mucous membrane, the throat, et cetera. I mean, zinc is an excellent antiviral, and, you know, zinc comes in usually 25, 30, up to 50 milligram tablets, but zinc lozenges, and they're used for colds all the time. I mean, you go into a drugstore and you look at the zinc lozenges with elderberry or whatever, and there's the multiple choices. Mm-hmm. So it's well known, you know, that zinc is an excellent antiviral, excellent cold remedy, which most colds are tend to be viral.
Mm-hmm.
And so zinc, now acetate, I believe Jonathan Wright taught me this years ago. I think Jonathan Wright is one of the top MDs in the United States in Seattle. Of course, he's in his 70s too. But zinc acetate disassociates quicker and has a greater penetration. But apparently all the zinc lozenges are fine. So I would say if you took a zinc lozenge every other day,
mm-hmm.
Or daily, or if you're dealing with a therapeutic need, you could double up. There's really no risk with zinc up to 50 milligrams, and with women even higher. With men, there's studies that zinc dosages above 50 milligrams can lower HDL cholesterol. That's, you know, sometimes referred to as the good cholesterol, the high density cholesterol.
Mm.
But right now, we don't need to be too concerned about that aspect of it. But zinc under, you know, up to 50 milligrams a day is certainly a safe dose. If you're long-term with zinc, if you've been using zinc denture adhesives, which the adhesive in some of the brands of denture adhesives have high levels of zinc. Zinc is used a lot in glues and adhesives.
Mm.
And there was a report a couple years ago about these people had such everyday zinc in the mouth, dentures for years, that it would deplete copper. So if there's any doubt about zinc, take 2 milligrams of copper a day.
Hmm.
That will balance out copper relationship, which is a key mineral relationship in the body and is revealed both in hair analysis and in blood analysis.
Hmm.
So, but zinc is a great antiviral.
Wow, is that ever good news?
Yeah. Another antiviral that is wonderful is the mushroom or herbal mushroom product, Agaricon. Agaricon.
Agaricon?
K-O-N.
Okay.
Agaricon. Agaricon. Host Defense is one brand that's made right here in Washington. There are many brands, though, of Agaricon. There are different aspects of mushroom therapy, but basically Agaricon is the premier antiviral in that family, Agaricon. So that's an option that you can work with as well. And frankly, I would take a cap at least every other day or even daily. And then you also have the option of taking a capsule or two twice a day in a therapeutic situation. So that's a consideration. Another item that Blaylock likes is turmeric.
Okay.
Turmeric is it's not really an antiviral per se, but it is a anti-inflammatory. And remember, the cytokine storm that's driven by the immune system in response to the viral infection is really what kills and the consequences of that. And so the turmeric is an anti-inflammatory to kind of put an edge on the cytokine storm. Yeah, these are things that I'm going to do. I take turmeric daily. I take vitamin C daily. I'm going to work with some zinc lozenges. I don't typically take zinc daily. I don't typically take NAC daily. I do take vitamin D daily. So these are things that I'm just working with as a routine. Other things to consider that aren't necessarily specific to coronavirus, but are definitely factors with viruses in general, would be lauric acid. Lauric acid is sold as monolaurin or lauricidin. Lauric acid is what the immune system makes as an antiviral. It's a medium-chain triglyceride.
How do you spell that?
Lauric, L-A-U-R-I-C.
L-A-U-R-I-C. Okay, thank you.
So there's a range of medium-chain triglycerides, and lauric acid is one of them, and it happens to be antiviral. And it's used especially with Epstein-Barr virus. So lauricidin, monolaurin, you know, Epstein-Barr is mononucleosis, so the trade names kind of tell you a little bit about it. Monolaurin, lauricidin, these are all products that are antiviral in general, but may not be specific to coronavirus.
Mm.
So that's another thing. And it became somewhat popular in bulletproof coffee, people would...
Mm-hmm.
And it's found in coconut oil. All of your medium-chain triglycerides are found in coconut oil. Coconut oil, 60% medium-chain triglycerides. Very unique product.
Hmm.
And lauric acid will be extracted from coconut oil.
Hmm.
More of the viral focus because it's a concentration of lauric acid. Normally with coconut oil, you'll get the entire range of medium-chain triglycerides, which is fine too. and might be adequate in and of itself as an antiviral or as general support for the immune system. But if you want to focus on the viral characteristics, it would be lauric acid. Mm-hmm. Caprylic acid is another medium-chain triglyceride that some people have used, and that's used as a yeast remedy, a candida remedy, et cetera. So, and Bulletproof Coffee was the addition of medium-chain triglycerides. I think the concentration in brain octane, which was their main product, was lauric acid, but I'm not sure of that. But you add the medium-chain triglycerides to your coffee and you drink it. I don't drink coffee, but for those who do, mm-hmm. and it puts you into a quick state of ketosis because it's a medium-chain triglyceride, so it burns quickly. Most of your dietary fats are long carbon chains, and they burn slowly. But medium-chain is a smaller chain. It burns quickly. And it's a great for energy. And they got onto it with the Mongolians. They put yak butter in their tea. It doesn't have to be coffee. Yeah.
We don't really have yak butter around here, do we?
We don't. Dave Asprey, who owns the Bulletproof business, he kind of got onto this. I don't know exactly how he sorted it out, but it's been a huge hit. It's helped a lot of people. It's a way of putting yourself into a fairly quick ketosis. It's great for the liver. It's excellent for the immune system. You know, it has a lot of benefits. And coming up with a supplement that you add to your coffee was the most brilliant marketing ploy I've ever heard of. You know,
every
people drink coffee. We just put this in your coffee. There's your supplement for the day.
It's probably good for your skin, too, you know.
Sure.
Anyway, we have to call a halt to this. So finish what you're saying. Go ahead.
One other thing, if I could, and I know colloidal silver is right now getting a lot of criticism because some television evangelist promoted it for $300 a pint. But colloidal silver is dynamite. If I personally thought that I was going to be exposed or I was exposed, I had a hunch of that, I would come home and use the colloidal silver nasal spray. I'd spray it in my mouth, my throat, my sinuses, my nasal cavities, etc. I mean, those are, to me, some of the real legitimate antiviral things that you can do preventatively and therapeutically.
Wow, that's good to know, isn't it? I've never used colloidal silver.
You've never used it? I have been amazed by that stuff over the years. And at first I was reluctant because, Argyria and all these things that are a possibility. When you really, really overdose on it, Argyria is when you become tainted in color, like a grayish kind of silver color that's irreversible.
Oh.
But that was much more common when people use silver nitrate and or people that used exceedingly large amounts of silver and literally drink it by the pint a day, that kind of a thing. So as far as spraying it in your sinuses, in your mouth, your throat, there, at 10 parts per million, there's no risk with colloidal silver, and it's a dynamite antiviral, antibacterial, outstanding.
Wow.
I've been totally nothing but impressed with colloidal silver.
Oh, boy.
Lower potency, just as effective as high potencies.
Wow, isn't that wonderful news? Well, Jim, I have to say goodbye, but I'm wondering if you'll come back on and take another run at this kind of subject in a while. You've given us a lot of information.
Absolutely. I realized that was kind of... Next time we'll skip the politics and just get into the preventative and therapeutic aspects and whatever, because who knows how the politics are going to shake out.
I know, yeah. But I don't think it hurts us to kind of be aware that there's some, you know... Anyway, that's...
There is a lot of controversy, actually, when you really dig into it. Where did this come from? How was it, released? And to me, that's kind of all water over the dam. The bottom line is now it's here, and we have to deal with it. And then the next controversy is going to be the next controversy is going to be the vaccine.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask if you'd come on and we could discuss that at some point soon. I want to say thank you, and you could tell people how to get hold of you because you are a real fount of knowledge and a very compassionate helper of people empowering their health.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. I always enjoy our time.
I do too. So we'll talk again. Thank you, Jim Emke.
Okay. Thank you, Veronica.
All right.
Bye for now.
Bye.